Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I mentioned on Sunday morning, for those of you that are here tonight that weren't here on Sunday morning, after we get through with 2 Samuel, which will be a few more weeks because there's 24 chapters and we're in the middle of chapter 17 right now. But after we're done with this, on Wednesday nights, we're going to take however long it takes to go back to the basics, and I'm going to be teaching systematic theology here, which I think is going to be beneficial to everybody. I'm really going to be encouraging all the GCA folk, especially the young folk.
Young folks out
here. I'm going to encourage them to come and go through it with us. As we get closer to it, I'll give you some idea what the materials are going to be. But I've read several systematics in my life. I think what I'll probably end up doing is picking my 3 or 4 favorites and kind of coalescing that information and presenting it. Otherwise, you know, I could just say to you, get Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, read it, there will be a quiz later. You know, so in order to kind of bring something else to the party, I'm going to coalesce ideas from different places and stuff. But we're going to turn Wednesday nights into Theology 101 classroom for a while, because on Wednesday nights we've been very loyal to Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, and we're either going to continue that into the Kings and the Chronicles, which would take a very long time, or I was speculating about going into the Psalms, which would also take a very long time, but the conversation at the men's meeting just put that bug in my head where I realized the best, I think, most beneficial thing that I could do right now for us as a church body is to go back teaching theological subject matter instead of just doing the expositional stuff. So Sunday mornings we'll continue expositional stuff. Midweek we'll do Theology 101 stuff, and we'll just see where that takes us. So that's the plan. Turn to 2 Samuel 17. Do you know the song, Farther Along? Farther along we'll know more about it. Farther along we'll understand why. Cheer up, my brethren, and live in the sunlight. We'll understand it all by and by. There's a line in that song that says, while there are others gone on before us, never molested, though in the wrong. And that's an interesting phrase. What the songwriter was getting at was, if you're a godly person in this world, you look around you and you see a lot of evil and you see a lot of godlessness in the world. And it seems oftentimes that the godless people seem to thrive in this world. And you wonder why it is that they can go on before us never molested. That's a good old phrase. It just means not hurt or harmed in any way, and yet they're wrong. I was watching last night President Obama's State of His Ego address, and I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
I thought it was a nice segue.
Did you like that? Yeah. His apparent State of the Union, that's purportedly what it was going to be, but it was really all about him. And really started singing that song as I was watching portions of it, thinking, how is it that these things go on in the world, the amount of just transparent dishonesty that there was in that speech? And we're watching all of these things happening in Washington that I'm not going to get political this evening, but it's just a real obvious current example of watching the world get progressively more godless and watching the world operate on mistruths and twisted information presented as if it's genuine truth. And that there are people who will believe it simply by virtue of how well it was presented. Or the setting. All of that makes people think, well, these people must know what they're doing. After all, they're the rich and powerful. They're in Washington. They must know what they're doing. Well, I said all that to say, the comfort that I get from Scripture, especially from what we're going to look at today, is that this is yet another demonstration of the fact that God not only knows, but he knows intimately, he knows in detail, he knows to the minutia, he deals with individuals, and he has plans for every person. I have often argued that if God didn't want, for instance, Satan in the garden, when you read in the book of Revelation, you know that God throws Satan into an abyss, locks him up for 1,000 years, lets him go for a short season, and then puts him in the lake of fire. Which means that when you go back and read, like in Isaiah or in Ezekiel, when they talk about the fall of Satan, Satan's rebellion, Satan getting lifted up in his own beauty, and saying things like, I will build my throne in the place of the north, and I will be worshipped as God, it means that God really could have, at that very moment, said, well, lake of fire. But he didn't, because he had a plan, and he uses Satan for his own purposes. And he allowed Satan into the garden so that there would be a fall, so that there would be a people who did need to be redeemed, so that his son, who is referred to as the lamb slain before the foundation of the world, would have a purpose to come into humanity and a people to save. It's all part of God's great big plan. God, in his magnificent sovereignty, actually knows what he's doing. Yeah, I know. Shocker, huh? I appreciate your cynicism at that moment. We've raised another sarcastic young man. I take full responsibility. My point being, we're going to see the end now of the story that we left dangling last week when we got to verse 14 and we found out that Absalom and all the men of Israel said the counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. And the next statement says, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. Now that's a remarkable statement. But basically, just to give you a quick background here, when David had to run from his son Absalom, and he took the people that were loyal to him with him, and they went out into the wilderness and went into hiding, but he had this great number of people who were with him, mostly people from the area of Judah who ran with the king, and Absalom was setting himself up as king of Israel, mostly the northern tribes, the northern ten, and was beginning an insurrection against the king, and so he was on his way south in order to set himself up as king in Jerusalem, having established himself as king at Hebron. And when he was doing that, two of the men who were traveling with David, who were his counselors, first this guy Ahithophel. Ahithophel was a counselor of David's, and we read last week that everybody treated the counsel of Ahithophel like it was words straight from God. People really appreciated what this man had to say, and they took his counsel as always being good counsel. People would listen to him, kings would listen to him, and both Absalom and David treated him that way. And so he stayed with Absalom against David, so he was part of the insurrection. But then David had another counselor, this Hushai, the Archite, that was traveling with him, and David said, go back to Jerusalem, tell Absalom that the way you served me is the way you're going to serve him, and then you be there to counteract the counsel that he's going to be getting from Ahithophel, because Ahithophel knows me well, knows how I act and react, knows what I'm going to do, and his counsel is going to be a problem. So you go there and counteract that counsel for me. And that's what Ahithophel was doing. Meanwhile, there's also this priest, Zadok, and his two sons, and he has sent them back into Jerusalem and said, if you hear anything, send word to me. You're going to see the network of spies that are going to bring information to David. Yes, the counter-spies that were infiltrating and finding out what was happening back in Jerusalem. They're going to tell David what's going on. And so Absalom asks Ahithophel, what's the best move here? And Ahithophel basically says to him, well, really, it's all about David. If you can just get David, then all of the people of Israel will come back and you'll be their king. And so his plan is, let's just go get David. I'll go, we'll seek him out, we'll find him, individually we'll get him, we'll kill him, and then the people will be saved. Well, that actually, in terms of warfare, was a good plan. Save the people, just get the person who's at the head of it, and that'll be the plan. And then Hushai comes along and says, you know, your father is a very good warrior and a good planner, and he's not going to be where you think he's going to be. In fact, he's not going to be with the people. There's going to be the people somewhere, but then there's also going to be David somewhere in the woods, or he's going to be in a cave, or he's going to be hiding somewhere, and that's the way it's going to work. You're going to have to overwhelm him with force. Get all the people of Israel together, and you lead the army, Absalom, and you go in, because if they go in to begin with and start fighting, David's men are good warriors, and he's got the mighty men with him, and as soon as there's the first little bit of victory on behalf of David, word's going to get out that you're being routed, and people's hearts are going to turn, and so what you need to do is lead the charge, go in, and let's go get David, the people, throw down that entire instruction, you'll come back the conquering king. Well, it turns out that Ahithophel gave the better advice, which is just take out one man, save the people alive. Whereas Hushai's counsel was, let's get in there and go to war, Israel against Israel. And actually, in many ways, it was kind of Israel against Judah. And let's get in there and let's really fight against it. Well, that was actually the worst advice of the two. And yet, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. That's what Absalom came to decide. Why did Absalom, of his own free will, decide that the plan where he rode in as the conquering hero was the better plan? Why? Because God ordained some calamity for Absalom. So Absalom had to go into the war in order to bring the calamity about. And so God sends two different men with two different bits of counsel. Ahithophel, who actually had the better counsel and had always been trusted in his counsel, gets overthrown by Hushai's counsel, which is going to end up with Absalom going into the battle himself because God himself already had it out for Absalom. Now, he had it out for Absalom because Absalom, of course, is trying to overthrow the rulership that God himself has already ordained. This is God's anointed king over Israel. And Absalom, his son, is now rebelling against his father. And so God is on David's side and going to protect David against his own son and has ordained a calamity for Absalom. But here's the point. All of this was in my head last night because I've been studying this, getting ready, of course, for tonight. And all of this was in my head as I was watching the president last night and as I was singing, Father alone will know more about it. And I kept coming back and saying, God ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. In the end, God always does what is right and just and proper. And even though we may not see it right now, and even though we may not even see it in our lifetime.
In his time,
God is going to bring about proper justice. You know, judgment is real. God is real. When you leave this planet, you stand before the judge of the whole universe. It would be real easy for us to just say, well, you know, the country is becoming increasingly more godless, and we who are Christian, who hold the biblical principles, boy, it really looks like we're really on our own out here because we're certainly not getting any support from Washington. We're certainly not getting any support from our leadership anymore. What about this? Well, the same God who had a plan of calamity for Absalom is still on the throne today. And you know how God is finally going to get Absalom? Absalom's going to be riding on a donkey when his neck is going to get caught in the branch of a tree, and he's going to end up dangling in the tree, still alive, till his enemies find him. God can do this. In our life, we're going to see lots of people in lots of situations where we're going to say, boy, how do they get away with that? There are so many folk on the internet who have become so very bold, sitting there behind their keyboards, anonymously writing detestable things. And there are so many sites now that are dedicated to atheism. And so they've become very bold. They have found each other via the internet, and they feed off each other. And so they write really horrific, despicable things. And you think, how does God let them get away with this? Well, my point is, if God can be this specific after one guy to take care of that one guy, then he is equally specific in things like choosing and electing. He chose Carol individually because he wrote Carol's name down in the Lamb's Book of Life. That also means, by the way, that he knows every name that he has not written in the book, because he knows the name of every star, and he knows how many hairs are on a man's head. He has ordained how many breaths we take, how many beats of our heart, how many days we're going to live, how many steps we're going to step. And he has decided and determined between all human beings who is going to end up in his presence forgiven and who's going to end up in his presence judged, because that's just how sovereign he is. And therefore, when we see this kind of behavior among sinful people, I had a conversation just, I guess yesterday it was, with a woman, and she was talking about problems that were going on in her family and in marriages of her children. And I said, please remember that all that marriage is two individual sinners making a pact to join together in a marriage. And so you're still going to have two sinful people who have simply joined together. At this point, we're talking about unbelieving people to begin with. But I was saying, you know, you take a couple of people who are sinful in their own right, you put them together in a marriage, and they're still sinful people. And so I said to her, I'm never surprised when sinful people do sinful things. You're telling me that these people who are unregenerate people, who are unsaved people, are doing sinful things. Where is the shock here? Where is the surprise here? If the Bible is true, then sinful people do sinful, wicked things because they're sinful and wicked. And that's just how that's going to be. But the fact that they do it doesn't mean that they're getting away with it. If we see anything consistently in the Bible, it's that God knows, he keeps track, he understands, and he has not only ordained a time and a place to save all of his elect people, but he has ordained a time and a place where all of his enemies are ultimately going to be judged. Some in this lifetime, some in the life to come. But nobody, nobody gets away with it. Understand that? And there's comfort in that. There's comfort in knowing that the judge of all the world will do right. And how remarkably foolish do you have to be to go through your whole life ignoring that fact? Since death is inevitable, since you're gonna die. And so you're what? You're gonna throw the great big dice, you're gonna take the great big gamble and gamble on eternity that maybe, just maybe, God's not there. And you have no way of knowing for certain till you die. And then if he is there, you're in tremendous trouble. And so then you just recreate a God after your own liking, your own imagination. And you say, well, sure, God's there, but he's just really, really malleable and understanding. And he's just overwhelmingly loving of all people all the time. And so he's not going to judge people. And he's going to know that, well, my heart was in a good place. And, you know, even though, I mean, come on, sure, you know, we were in favor of infanticide, but just think of all the women's lives we improved by killing those babies. I mean, he's going to understand. This is the way people think. But if the God who is, the God who told Moses, I am, if that God actually is, if he actually exists, if he actually lives, if he actually is the way he's described in the Bible, then he's not real malleable and understanding. Because he's a God who does things like lay down the law. You know, he's a God who says, this is how it's done. This is a God who says, come and worship me my way. If you don't do it my way, I kill you. That's that God. And it's still the same God who still says, there's only one way you approach me. It's by my son. You either come via my son or I'm your judge. And there's no way around that. So farther along we'll. Chapter 17, verse 14. Then all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel. in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. Then Hushai said to Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, "This is what Ahithophel counseled Absalom and the elders of Israel, and this is what I have counseled. Now, therefore, send quickly and tell David, saying, 'Do not spend the night at the fords in the wilderness, but by all means cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be destroyed.'" Now, Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying at El Rogel, and a maidservant would go and tell them, and then they would go and tell King David, for they could not be seen entering the city. So they had this whole network of people who would tell people who would tell people in order to get a private message to David so that there would be no indication of what city David was hiding in. But a child, a lad, verse 18, did see them and told Absalom. So the two of them departed quickly and came to the house of a man of Bahurim who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. In other words, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, who were carrying this message, were now down inside the well, and a woman took a covering, spread it over the well's mouth, scattered grain on it so that nothing was known. Then Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house and said, "Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" And the woman said to them, "They have crossed the brook of water." And when they searched for them, they could not find them, so they returned to Jerusalem. And it came about, after they had departed, that they came up out of the well, and they went and they told King David. And they said to David, "Arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus Ahithophel has counseled against you." Then David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed the Jordan, and by dawn not even one remained who had not crossed the Jordan. Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and arose, went to his home, to his city, set his house in order, and strangled himself. Thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. Why do you think he would have done that?
Well, he thought Absalom was about to lose and he was on the wrong side.
I think, number one, he realizes Absalom didn't take his advice, which means if this goes bad, he's in trouble. And he's already taken sides against David. So whichever person wins, he's on the outside. Yeah. And so he just gave up, killed himself. That's the end of Ahithophel.
And since Absalom decided not to take advice, he's really of no use.
Exactly. He's no longer a counselor that the king trusts, right? And by the way, he might have also realized that since his was the good advice, if they took the opposite advice, David's going to win. And when David wins, I've already taken sides with his enemy. It's a no-win situation. So he was buried in the grave of his father. Verse 24, then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom set Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Ithra the Israelite, who went into Abigail, who was the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So now we know who he is specifically. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. And when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the sons of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds and basins and pottery and wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey, curds, sheep, and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." Then David numbered the people that were with him, and he set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, which gives you some idea how many people were with David. It was quite an exodus of folks crossing the Jordan together with him if he needed commanders of thousands and hundreds. Verse 2, and David sent the people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third of the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, "I myself will surely go out with you also." But the people said, "You shall not go out, For if we indeed flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city." And they're right. In terms of ending the war, it's going to come down to David and Absalom, which is why the original Ahithophel advice was such good advice when he said, just go after David. If you just get David, all the people will come back to you, Absalom, and you'll be the king of all of them. And they realized that. They said, look, even if we all go out and die, you still being alive means that Absalom is not yet king. But if they get you, then the whole thing is overthrown. So they wisely said, no, you're worth more than 10,000 of us, so it's better for you to remain here inside the walls of the city and help us from there. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. So they all know that David's desire is, because it is his son, it is his child. Even though his son is rebelling against him and trying to take over the throne of Israel, he still gives a command, and you need to understand this command to understand what happens later in the story. Because when David gets the news that Absalom is dead, then David is going to go about weeping over Absalom and crying, and that's going to make the people who defended him start to turn on David and say, wait a minute, we're the people who defended you, and you're crying over your enemy, and so you must hate us? And so it's a touchy political situation that David's going to find himself in. But it starts with him saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men. In other words, Ahithophel was right. That if the first part of what he said is, if you go in and fight against those people, they're going to beat you, and their word's going to get out that David's army is beating your army, and the people are not going to look at you as the leader and as a king. So we need to all go in together and fight, and you need to come back like the conquering hero. But it shows that Ahithophel understood that David's people were going to be loyal to him and fight with everything they have for their king. Verse 6, the people went out into the field against Israel. The battle was in Ephraim. 20,000 men were slaughtered. Verse 8, for the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more men that day than the sword devoured. Now, isn't that interesting language? That means there were many, many people who died in the forest one way or another. Now we're going to see an example of it. Now, Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. I like the phrase, he happened to meet the servants of David. Happened. It just happened. This is the same guy who God had ordained to bring calamity to. And then it just happened that he met the servants of David. God just got lucky there. And so it happened that he met the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak tree, and his head caught fast in the oak, so that he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going. So the image there is that probably he got caught by the neck, and that a fork of branches caught him by the head, and the mule kept going, and next thing he knows, he's dangling in the tree, still alive, but dangling, it says, between heaven and earth, meaning his feet didn't touch the ground, and he's just hanging there in the air, and that's when he just happened to meet the servants of David, because he's there dangling in a tree, defenseless. Why was he dangling in a tree, defenseless? You'll notice that he was not overwhelmed by power or might of another man. You'll notice that he ended up the victim of a donkey in a hurry and a tree. Meaning that God can get whoever he wants, however he wants. He doesn't even need you to do it. He can use a donkey to do it if that's what he decides to do. The same way that he could make Balaam's donkey talk, he could make this donkey make sure that Absalom wound up dangling in a tree, and then the donkey just takes off. Donkey's like, well, my work's done here. I'm hungry. E-aw. Or Eeyore, depending on which book you're reading. Did you actually go, aw? Was that the Winnie the Pooh reference did something for you, huh? Oh, no, I've wandered a very long way away from the story, haven't I? You know, I just mentioned Balaam's donkey, so as long as we're laughing a bit, I'll tell you this quick quote, and then we'll move on. Some of you have heard me say this before, but Elder Ward one time said, in the Bible, it's a miracle when an ass speaks. And in real life, it's a miracle if he doesn't. Yeah. So. There are lots of people on the internet who at this very moment are thinking, Jim's out of stories. He's telling the same stories over and over now. So there he is, dangling between heaven and earth, caught in a tree, and he just happens to meet the servants of David. Verse 10, when a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree. Then Joab said to the man who had told him that, now behold, you saw him. Why did you not strike him there to the ground? In other words, why didn't you kill him? Why'd you leave him hanging there? I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. And the man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect for me the young man Absalom. That means everybody knew that the rule was, go easy on Absalom. Capture him, but don't kill him. So even for 1,000 pieces of silver, I wouldn't have done it. Now look how well he knows Joab in verse 13. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there's nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. In other words, you'd have left me standing there just waving in the breeze going, yeah, he did it. He killed him, king. And so the king would have taken out his vengeance on this poor guy. And he knew Joab well enough to know that Joab would have just left him dangling too. Joab said, I will not waste time here with you. Well, yeah, he's a little offended now. Yeah, since you've got me completely figured out, enough with you. I'm not going to waste time here with you. So he took 3 spears in his hand and he thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. In other words, he being the leader of David's army, he stopped the army. The war is over. We've captured the king. Well, we've killed the king. And they took Absalom, and they cast him into a deep pit in the forest, and they erected over him a great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, each to his own tent. Those were all those that had lined up behind Absalom, are now fleeing. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to preserve my name. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this very day. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies. Now this is the son of the priest, which means he's in the line for the priesthood. And he's anxious. He wants to be the guy who gets to tell the king, because whoever brings the king good news gets a reward. And after all, he and his father were part of the network of folks who were bringing news to David. He would like to go run to David and tell David the good news. Joab said to him, You are not the man to carry news this day, but you shall carry news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead. In other words, this needs to be handled delicately. And you, after all, are a priest's son, so you're not the guy to go carry this news. So then Joab picked somebody. He said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. So the Cushite bowed down to Joab and ran. Now Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why would you run, my son, since you will have no reward for going? Because the Cushite's going to get there first. He's going to get the reward. Why do you want to be the runner on this one? He said, but whatever happens, verse 23, whatever happens, I'm going to run. So he said to him, well, then run. Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain, and he passed up the Cushite, who took off ahead of him. So this is a major runner. This is a guy who knows how to carry news. Now, David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went to the roof of the gate by the wall, raised his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running by himself. And the watchman called and told the king, and the king said, if he's by himself, then there's good news in his mouth. And he came nearer and nearer, and then the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, behold, another man running by himself. And the king said, this one is also bringing good news. David figured out if there's two individuals and they're both running like the dickens to come here, they're competing to bring good news. And the watchman said, I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. That means everybody knows this is a good runner. And they say, this guy's just taken off. I know who this is. And the king said, this is a good man, and he comes with good news. And Ahimaaz called and said to the king, all is well. And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And he said, blessed is the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against the Lord my king, or against my lord the king. And the king said, is everything well with the young man Absalom? And Ahimaaz said, uh-oh. Well, it's not exactly what he said. He sidestepped the question and said, when Joab sent me, the king's servant, and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I didn't know what it was. In other words, there's some more news. I don't know what it is. But I just wanted to be the first one to tell you that the Lord has delivered you, and it's all good, and you're going to be king. I want to be the guy to carry that information. What about my son? No clue. Don't really know. But there's a guy behind me. Yeah, if you're going to be mad at somebody, I'm thinking the Cushite is a good candidate. So the king said, turn aside and stand here. In other words, you've said your piece, stand over there. So he turned aside and he stood still, and behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. Then the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. That was his roundabout way of saying, Absalom's dead. And may all your enemies die the same way. And the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. And thus he said as he walked, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Then it was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day, which should have been great, everybody should be happy, yay, David's returned to his kingdom. Instead, that victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people, for the people heard it said that day that the king is grieved for his son. So here they had risked life and limb, gone out there and fought, killed 20,000, Finally, Absalom is killed. All Israel is scattered back to their tents. David's going to be restored to his throne. They want appreciation from the king. They want David to congratulate them and say, well done, good fight. You know, this should be a day of celebration. And instead, David's walking around saying, oh, my son, Absalom. And this is what comes of it. So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee away from a battle. In other words, instead of being able to have a victorious parade back to the city where David was, we're the mighty conquering victors. They came in quietly with their heads down, came in by stealth, and it says they look like the kind of turncoats who run away in the middle of a war. The king covered his face and he cried with a loud voice, oh, my son, Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of all your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines. Now, by loving those who hated you and by hating those who love you, you've done this. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you'd be pleased. Well, Joab's giving good counsel to David here and saying, do you see the impression? I'll use a very popular word in politics today. Do you see the optics? Do you see the way this looks? The people who loved you so much that they were willing to lay down their own life for you fought against your enemy, Absalom. Now your enemy is dead and you're mourning over him and making all your servants and your captains and the people who fought for you and loved you, you're making them all feel bad. You have it all upside down, David. Now therefore arise. Go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. In other words, you're out here in this foreign city and you're protected because they're all with you. And if you don't go out and say something to them now, they're going to go home. And you're going to be out here by yourself and when the king of Israel is left unprotected in the middle of a foreign land, well, then you're really going to be in trouble. So the king arose and sat in the gate. And when they told all the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, then all the people came before the king. Now Israel, the enemies that had followed Absalom, now Israel had fled each to his own tent. The imagery there being that the people had fought against David all fled back to their homes, but the people who were with David now are encompassing about their king that they had fought for. All the people were quarreling throughout the tribes of Israel, all those that had gone back to their homes, and they were saying, the king delivered us from the hands of our enemies, and he saved us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. Notice now they're like real pro-David. A little while ago, they were, Absalom, he's our God. What? He's dead? David, we love David. However, Absalom, who we appointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? Now, what this is about is that when a king would be removed from his throne for any period of time, when he was restored, there would be a big procession. And the people of the king would go to where he was and receive him and bring him back as a sign of loyalty and a show that they recognize him as their king. And they're saying, with everything that David has done for us, and of course it says they're quarreling about it, arguing amongst themselves, the king delivered us from the hands of our enemies. He saved us from the hand of the Philistines. Now he's fled out of the land from Absalom, but Absalom, who we had anointed over us as king, has died in the battle. So now then, why are we silent? We need to go and bring the king back. Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, the southern kingdom, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house. So Israel, the people who rebelled, are saying, we need to bring David back. That news gets to David. David says to Judah, his own kin and tribe and family, says, why aren't you coming to get me? You're the people who ought to be leading this charge, essentially. Verse 12, you are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also, if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. So he says, you go tell this Amasa that he's my own family and I'm going to make him the leader over my army. He needs to come and get me, essentially. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah like one man, so that they sent word to the king, saying, return, you and all your servants. And the king then returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go and to meet the king and to bring the king across the Jordan, which would bring him back into the land of Israel. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down, and the men of Judah, to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and with his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they rushed to the Jordan before the king, and they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in the king's sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king should take it to heart. You remember what he did? Remember Shimei? Remember what he did?
He was running around,
throwing curses at him. He's the one who is a descendant of Saul's family and a fan of Saul, and he came and cursed David and threw rocks and stones at him. And back then, they were hoping it was going to restore the kingdom to Saul. Exactly. So David's men said, do you want us to kill him? Why should this dog live and get to do this? And David said, it may be that the Lord has told him to curse David. Remember all that now? And so he now comes to David and says, you know what? Let's not talk about that. Remember when I did that? Oh, you're king again. Hey, it's all good. Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when the Lord my king came out of Jerusalem, so that the king should not take it to heart. Exactly. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down and meet my lord the king. I don't want to take too much time on this because I'm running out of time for the evening, but I do want to point something out here. You'll notice that this is all during David's life. This is pre-Solomon, before Solomon's reign, and this is before Solomon is told that the 10 northern tribes are going to be taken from him and given away to Rehoboam, and that for sake of David and the promise made to David, that the southern kingdom, Judah, would continue with David. But do you hear in this chapter the divisions that are already in place? The 10 tribes are being referred to as the house of Joseph. They're being referred to as Israel, the northern kingdom. Judah's being referred to as Judah. David is saying, Judah is my flesh and blood. The Benjamites are coming with the Judahites to come bring him back to Judah. These divisions are already clear all the way back here. And I just wanted to point that out, that it's not when Solomon has the kingdom divided from him that suddenly you see this division of kingdoms. The northern and the southern kingdoms recognize themselves as that even during the Davidic reign. But then again, we also read in Ezekiel chapter 23. Somebody turn there. In fact, let's all turn there. Ezekiel 23. Keep your finger where you are. After Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, chapter 23. Ezekiel speaks, the word of the Lord came to me again, saying, son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother, and they played the harlot in Egypt. You see how far back this goes? I just want you to get this. Now we're not talking reign of David. We're talking the 400 years that they were in Egypt. They played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There their breasts were pressed. And there their virgin bosom was handled. And their names were Aholah, the elder, and Aholibah, her sister. And they became mine. And they bore sons and daughters. And as for their names, Samaria, who is Samaria? The northern kingdom, Samaria is Aholah, and Jerusalem is Aholibah. And Aholah played the harlot while she was mine, and she lusted after her lovers, after the Assyrians, her neighbors. That's right. We know that the northern kingdom went into the Assyrian captivity, who were clothed in purple, governors and officials, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding on horses. She bestowed her harlotry upon them, all of whom were the choicest men of Assyria, and with all whom she lusted after, with all their idols she defiled herself. And then it goes on and describes it. She did not forsake her harlotries from the time of Egypt. And then, therefore, I gave her into the hands of her lovers, the Assyrians. Look at verse 11. Now her sister Aholibah saw all this, yet she was more corrupt in her lust than she, than her sister. And her harlotries were more than the harlotries of her sister, and she lusted after the Assyrians, governors and officials, and the ones that were near, magnificently dressed, horsemen riding on their horses, all of them desirable young men. And I saw that she had defiled herself, and they both took on the same way. So she increased her harlotries, on and on and on and on. Now, the point of Ezekiel 23 is that this is a prophecy against the northern and the southern tribes. So God says that they were mine, they belonged to me, they bore me sons and daughters, but he calls them erring sisters all the way back to Egypt. So in God's mind, in God's providential realization of what he was going to do with Israel, people sometimes get the impression that this division between the northern and the southern kingdoms happened at the point when Solomon had the 10 northern tribes taken from him. But in 2 Samuel here, as we're reading about Judah and Israel, the northern tribes, there's a clear division. And then Ezekiel 23 tells us that God saw that division while they were coming up way back in Egypt. And they chased after their foreign gods, and so he called that a harlotry, and then chased after the Assyrian foreign gods, so that's another. And then he said, you know, that Judah saw what erring Israel was doing, and that didn't improve it, and she chased after her lovers the same way that her older sister did. So it's all part of God's prophecies against Israel and Judah collectively, but he sees them from the beginning as a divided two sisters. Got that? Mm-hmm. All right, let's wrap this up for the night. We are in chapter 19, verse 19 is where Shimei has said, "Don't consider me guilty." Verse 20, "For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all my house of Joseph," that's the northern kingdom, "to go down and meet my lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, 'Should not Shimei be put to death for this? Because he cursed the Lord's anointed.' And David then said," this is David having learned mercy after everything he's been through, "'What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am the king of Israel, or the king over Israel today?' And the king said to Shimei, 'You shall not die.' Thus the king swore to him." Then Mephibosheth, everything's getting rectified now. Remember there was this guy Ziba. Remember what Ziba did? Brought several donkeys full of food and everything else out to David. David said, "Where's your master?" And he said, "Well, he's back in Jerusalem hanging with Absalom because he's hoping that you're going to restore the throne of Saul now. And he's the heir of Saul back there. Maybe he, the lame guy, is going to be the next king of Israel. Who knows?" And of course, David has shown nothing but kindness and had him eating at the king's table all this time. So David told Ziba, "Well, then everything that belongs to him is now yours." Okay, so now he meets up with Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, who came down to meet the king. And he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes, from the day that the king departed until the day that he came home in peace. In other words, he mourned for David the whole time. His feet had been broken. He was a lame man. He didn't do anything to take care of his feet. He didn't trim his mustache, so it just kept growing. Didn't wash his clothes. He was mourning over David. So when David saw him in that condition, it was clear that he'd been in mourning the whole time. And so it was that when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, "Oh, my lord, the king, my servant, deceived me. For your servant, me, I said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he, Ziba, has slandered your servant to the Lord my king. But my lord, the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who ate at your table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king?" So the king said to him, "Why do you still speak of your affairs? I've already decided. You and Ziba will divide the land." And Mephibosheth said to him, "Let him have all of it, since the Lord my king has come safely into his own house." There's humility. Throws himself completely at the feet of David and says, "I don't even want the land. I don't even want the inheritance. I'm just happy you're okay." That's loyalty. Verse 31. Now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogalim, and he went on to the Jordan with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Now Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old, and he had sustained the king while he stayed with him at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. In other words, he had a lot of wealth, and when David had come to Mahanaim, Barzillai had taken care of him. But now that the king is coming back, Barzillai, though he's 80, takes the time to go to escort the king across the Jordan. And the king said to Barzillai, "You cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me." In other words, come with me, come back to Jerusalem, and I'll take care of you for the rest of your life. You took care of me. But Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I yet to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good or bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more the voice of singing men and women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to the Lord my king? Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. However, here is your servant Chimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king, and you do for him what is good in your sight." So he says, "I'm old. I have no benefit in coming. Why should I be a burden to you? But here's my servant who I'm giving to you as a gift, and now you do whatever is good in your sight with him." And the king answered, "Chimham will cross over with me, and I will do for him what is good in your sight, and whatever you require of me, I will do for you." All the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too. And the king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his place. Now the king went to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel, accompanied the king. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with them over the Jordan?" So remember, they're the ones who fought against him, and then they ran to their houses. Then they had a dispute among themselves and said, "Hey, wasn't he a really good king? We need to go and bring him across the Jordan." And then, of course, David heard about that and said to the southern tribes, "Why are they the ones coming after me? You're my own flesh and blood. You should be coming to get me." So they did. And naturally, then the Israelites are there to argue about it and say, "Why have you stolen the king away from us?" But then look at the next phrase, given everything else that I've already said about the fact that these divisions between northern and southern tribe already existed. Listen to how specific this is. All the men of Judah answered and said, "Because the king is a close relative to us, why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense? or has anything been taken for us? In other words, we haven't cheated anybody. It's not like your stuff was given to us. But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king. What does that mean? It means we're 12 tribes, and we're the northern tribes. We're 10. So you see, this division already exists. It's already here, and they already understand it. We have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you do. Now, granted, we were going with his son. There was that thing. But now that he's king again, we got a 10-2 advantage going here. We have more claim to David than you do. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. We will pick up right there next week, and the story will continue. Isn't this a good story? Full of interest and intrigue, but also the fact that the writer of 2 Samuel took the time to include all these little important details that you can read right past and miss, but he took the time to include them. And if, in fact, this is all God-breathed stuff, then the details count, especially the fact that God had ordained to take care of Absalom on his own, and he was perfectly capable of hanging Absalom in a tree, dangling between heaven and earth, and he could do it with a donkey in a tree. Because God really is in that kind of control. And if God is for you, like he's for David, then God is going to save him and protect him regardless of how many people come against him. And God is able to save him with a tree and a donkey. But if God is against you, it doesn't matter how fast or how furiously you run away. You can't run away from God. It doesn't matter how many men you have in your army. He had the bigger army. And the momentum was with him, but God was against him.
And God knew that these people that he had chosen were still sinners.
Absolutely. Isn't that where we kind of began? Yeah. These are sinners. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're dealing with sinful folk to begin with, and so sinful stuff is going to happen. Rebellion's going to happen. But God continues.
Punishment's
going to take place. And God continues to be faithful to his people and the one that he chose, and he continues to be a righteous judge to those that are against him and against his plan and against who he chose and against his anointing. And that's the same God who's on the throne today, so we who are on his side need to be comforted by that fact.
And the only thing that's different between those that are saved and not saved is that those sinners admit their sins.
Well, yes. Yeah. We who are saved are quick to admit that we are sinners in the eyes of a holy God. Right. Whereas they, the sinners, instead will take their time to justify themselves and try to convince themselves that they're not that bad or that God is still on their side despite their rebellion. But repentant people take sides with God against themselves and say, no, God is good and right and holy. I'm the problem here. So, all right. I've kept you a bit late. I need to let you go.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.